Still to come in this broadcast, Brian Pillman will talk to the volatile Stone Cold Steve Austin. We'll hear more from Bret the Hitman Hart. And don't forget, Psycho Sid takes on one of the Grimm twins.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome to episode 96 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston, on the road on I-495 up in Massachusetts. Not I-495 on Long Island, because I'm one of the smart people. I never take the Long Island Expressway, even if it's recommended as the faster way. You just don't do it. No matter how horrifying the parkways might be down there, you always want to stay on them rather than be competing with the trucks. So that is why my voice sounds a little different right here, and I apologize to those of you who are offended by the audio quality of this, looking in your direction, Joe Marotta and Mike Crockett. I don't know why I decided to record it as I'm driving. It might be because there's nobody here with me. But then again, I also record at home and nobody is there listening to me other than the cat and the rest of the studio audience who shows up for that particular taping. Today, oh yeah, this is a wrestling podcast. I should probably say what it is that I'm going to be looking at. It'll be WWF Superstars from October 27th, 1996. One of the last superstars of any consequence that you'll see. Yes, there are international versions that were, you know, the Our Vantage Point podcast reviewed one of them from 1997 that was called by Ray Rougeau and Gorilla Monsoon in 1997, of all things. But here in 96, Superstars is on the USA Network on Sunday mornings because it had kind of fallen so far that the normal syndicated path that it had been on since 1986 when it launched at the beginning of September, when they overhauled all the television shows, that was now gone. The business was changing, as you can plainly see through all of 1996 with the NWO and, you know, Shawn Michaels is the new champion. Bret Hart isn't there, although he's returned by this point, which is something I'll get into on this show. You got other stuff like Hunter Hearst Helmsley. His punishment is coming to an end, actually, on this week in 96, winning the Intercontinental title off of Wildman Mark Mero. So there's a lot going on in the WWF, because in 96, I always see it as between WrestleMania and around this time, it's not all that exciting, but it's watchable for a couple of things. One of them being the rise of Stone Cold Steve Austin, who didn't adopt that name until, I want to say it was the beginning of March of 96, before he dropped that Ringmaster nonsense in the middle of the Savio Vega feud. He is Stone Cold by WrestleMania 12, and by this point, he's all up in Bret Hart's face, challenging him to face him, and Bret accepts that challenge to meet Austin at the Survivor Series in a match that certainly does speak for itself. So I've set the table a little bit. I'm kind of going backwards with this, where I'm kind of describing what's going to be on the show, where the main hook is Steve Austin, the Pillmanizing, if you will, of Brian Pillman, the shattering of his ankle, for which it is the last angle of any sort of consequence on Superstars. Because, yeah, there's a little angle advancement earlier in the show, in the Smoking Guns versus the New Rockers match, which, by the way, strap yourself in for that one because it's just full of excitement from start to finish. Marty Jannetty just on his game on that day. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown, and give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only and everything you can find there a little bit later on in the show. So obviously, I technically am coming back from Christmas right now on Long Island, where there's a lot of different things with my wife's family. We have a really nice dinner on Thanksgiving, which featured a 25-pound thing of beef. I don't even know what to call it. I don't know where you get something like that. At the risk of sounding like Gorilla Monsoon, maybe you get it at the Gorilla Monsoon supermarket. Oh, that slab of beef has got to be over that 40-pound mark. Probably got charged for... You get charged for 40 pounds for a 25-pound thing of beef at the Gorilla Monsoon supermarket. But it was certainly delicious. I'm glad they didn't ask me to assist in the cooking of it because I don't even think I could... I wouldn't even know where to begin. I was so frightened by the fact that it was just this large thing of, I guess you call it prime rib, but certainly delicious. Had more than my share of bourbon, wine, and pineapple-infused vodka. And I say more than my share because this is all on Christmas evening, and I had to drive back to Massachusetts to go to work by 9 a.m., the day after Christmas, which, fine, I would have felt a little bit better about it if I wasn't covering the early portion of cash reporting. I thought it was a little unfair that the guy who had to drive up from New York for it had to do that over the guy who has to drive, like, from the city of Boston to Westboro, which is like 30 minutes with no traffic. But hey, I mean, those are the breaks. As long as they keep paying me what they're paying me, I'm going to be fine with it. And I was able to get down to Long Island on Christmas Eve with virtually no traffic at all, which, if you've driven through Connecticut, one of America's worst states, sorry, everybody who might be from Connecticut, but you get to Norwalk, Connecticut, and you're always going to be just kind of sitting there. And that wasn't the case on Monday night. And it's always a pleasant surprise when that happens. And it only took me about 3 hours and 30 minutes racing down there. They're debuting a new Springsteen show that they had just released on the Sirius channel, E Street Radio, a Springsteen show from 79. There's not a lot of those out there. It was a No Nukes benefit where you had a walk-on appearance with Jackson Brown and Tom Petty, which I was thinking, of course, in terms of wrestling. Bruce Springsteen, Jackson Brown, and Tom Petty. If that's a trios team, I think I can, with all due respect to Jackson Brown, we know who's eating the pin if those three guys are going to lose a pro wrestling match. So when I get down there, there had been a lot of anticipation on Christmas morning. There are my two 8-year-old nephews. And eight-year-old boy, perfect age for Christmas and, you know, for what it's all about. But he also plays a lot of Madden 18, which is what it was. And I had played him last year and lost. I maybe mentioned it on the podcast, the episode I did after Christmas, 22-19, where it was basically we each scored 3 touchdowns, but I stupidly went for 2-point conversions and didn't get them. And I kicked an extra point on the last one. It was the difference in the game, more or less. Here, once again, he picked Atlanta in Madden 18. And I had a strategy going in as an 11-point underdog, which was I didn't know which team I was going to pick, but I was going to pick a team with a good running back, a quarterback who could maybe move a little bit and just try and bleed the clock dry like the Giants in Super Bowl 25. So I chose Dallas because of Ezekiel Elliott, who, by the way, he put the ball on the ground twice during this game, so he really wasn't much help at all. And I ended up winning the game by a score of 16-14. And the entire difference in the game was I went for two-point conversions after my touchdowns and managed to convert them both. And it took me a while to actually... I had to learn what the buttons were right beforehand because I don't play Xbox. I never had an Xbox or a PlayStation. These controllers are all new to me. But yet, somehow, I am proud of the fact that I was able to defeat an 8-year-old in Madden who... He's telling me he plays it all the time. Now, I let him know that I would have killed him if we were playing Tecmo Bowl because that's Pete's game, okay? I could play as the Patriots in that game, and I'm talking Tecmo Super Bowl, where the Patriots are the 1-15 version with Mark Wilson as the quarterback and George Adams as the, and I think John Stevens as the running back as well. So that was a lot of fun. And watching A Christmas Story as well on TBS. A lot of wrestling connotations in that movie, but I'm going to save that because I think next year I should just do a podcast devoted to that movie, just kind of from a wrestling perspective with the factions and whatnot, what match that Scott Farkas and Ralphie, when the two of them get into the fight. It certainly reminds me of a more recent wrestling match on a very high-profile pay-per-view that had a lot of controversy to it. But enough of my blather about wrestling and Christmas and all that. I said this is Superstars, October of 1996. And as I get into it, our commentary team is actually a new one that I don't think I've had before with Jim Ross and Mr. Perfect. Both guys are heels, as I'm going to describe, because of where those guys were at. Only recently with their little heel runs, Perfect, it was that very week on Monday Night Raw where he helped the aforementioned Hunter Hearst Helmsley win the Intercontinental title. And Jim Ross with his, oh boy, that infamous fake razor and fake diesel where he goes into the ring. It is one of the few things that I remember watching live in 1996 was Jim Ross doing that and just wondering what the hell they were trying to accomplish with that. And it's a rare instance of the 2020 vision looking back is kind of the same as then, although I have an understanding now that they were trying to establish copyrights, and me being, if I had ever gone to become a lawyer, I would have wanted to be a copyright lawyer because that's like the one area of the law that sort of fascinates me. So enough about that. I've done enough table setting for this show. I certainly hope the audio is not too bad on this. So I'm going to kick it off with a very painful sports moment that got me very, very angry even then in 1996. For this is episode 96, so I'll be playing both sports moments from 1996 and then one bonus one that was actually from news coverage of an event from 1996. So with all that in mind, let's get this show on the road, as it were.
In right field, Tarasco going back to the track, to the wall. And what happens here? He contends that a fan reaches up and touches it. But Richie Garcia says no, it's a home run. Here comes Davey Johnson out to argue as Jeter comes across to tie the game. Well, in postseason, you have an umpire down each line.
And he was there.
And Garcia was right there.
Let me count all the ways that that single play annoys me. And I wasn't even an Orioles fan then. I mean, that's 1996 American League Championship Series Game 1. Okay, I didn't become an Orioles fan until before the 2012 season. And this isn't even something where I had to retcon myself to be angry or upset about it. Like, oh, I hate the 79 Pirates because the Orioles blew that World Series to them. No, this is completely different because it's one of the great injustices. First of all, the call of it, Bob Costas completely milquetoast, not even telling telling it like it is, where the kid clearly reaches over the right field wall. Tarasco is about to make the catch at the wall with one out in the eighth inning, and the Orioles up a run. Then you got Joe Morgan on color, who shouldn't even be allowed to exist, at least in a broadcasting realm. I'm not going to go any further than that. Then you get Yankee fans who complain in other sports like, oh, I don't know, the tuck rule, and complain about a weird, quirky rule applied correctly that ended up benefiting the Patriots in a playoff game when, as I said, it was applied correctly. And then you have this, where in the playoffs in baseball, you have a right field umpire, so there are six umpires instead of four, and I've always wondered if you even really need those outfield umpires, and if you look at this, the guy is right there to make the call, Richie Garcia. He completely blows it. He admits it after the game, but what does it matter? Because they're not going to overturn it, because they didn't have replay then, and oh, yeah, the one thing that's never talked about when discussing this play is Richie Garcia years later ends up getting shit canned from MLB because he got caught up in a gambling scandal. Now, why can't anybody connect the freaking dots between what happened in this play? Here's a guy who had gambling debts with bookies, so MLB fires him, and in the 1996 playoffs, he screws up this obvious call that happens right in front of him, and kind of swings the series because the Orioles did win the next game. Of course, they did lose three straight games in Baltimore, so I'm not sure that it would have swung the series, but it's just a complete injustice. And if you're an official in any sport and your Wikipedia page has a whole section like where you can click the link for just controversies, you were pretty crappy at your job. So Richie Garcia, burn in hell. And one more thing, too, how the next day on the Today Show, they're like celebrating this kid reaching over and interfering. Well, he's just a kid. Yeah, okay. Should he be allowed to bring a fishing net out there and reach 30 feet over the wall? I mean, how much further does him being 12 years old have to go in order to excuse that?
Saw the ball coming and made an attempt, and unfortunately he interfered with the game, but the kid was just being a kid.
But we should also say he didn't actually hit the outfielder's glove. He just reached out and probably thought it was his fair grab.
Yes, let us all listen to Matt Lauer, one of the worst human beings who has ever existed in the world. Well, it's not like I masturbated into a potted plant or anything. I mean, come on. Stop making excuses. That kid should have been thrown in prison. And thank you for allowing me 4 minutes to relitigate this whole sorry ordeal. Show opens with Mr. Perfect, who, by the way, would have been a perfect baseball fan as well. They did all the vignettes with him as an athlete, but actually as a fan, he would have been just as good. And this goes back to the previous Monday's Raw, where he is run over by a cart of some kind, which is rather unusual. At least they didn't have it, you know, be a car, because that is a bit much. You know, you did that with Austin to put him out for a year. But as it turned out, this was all a ruse, which always kind of struck me as an odd angle that they would concoct that sort of thing just to throw people off the scent. I mean, put on the kayfabe hat for a minute, and it just seems really weird from A to Z. But hey, I'm not a cerebral assassin. And it ended up helping Triple H win the Intercontinental title from Mark Merrow, I almost said marvelous Mark Merrow, but he was certainly the wild man at that time, after Hunter had done 4 or 5 months of penance. But it's not as if he was going out on Raw every week and losing, because it was only a 1 hour show, and you'd see him in an enhancement match and Superstars picking up a win, but most of his time was losing on house shows to Mark Merrow, and that was the most common one, The Stalker, Barry Windham, Jake the Snake Roberts, and then he had a weird little series of matches with Steve Austin, including at In Your House, which came the previous Sunday to this on the 20th, and he was actually filling in for Savio Vega, who was actually hurt and, quite frankly, made that match more interesting. Mostly interesting because both guys are still nominally heels, and having a match like that on pay-per-view was extremely rare for the WWF. My favorite result for Hunter Hearst Helmsley in the summer of 1996 is from a Nassau Coliseum house show. On August 25th of 96, Mark Merrow and Savio Vega defeat Hunter Hearst Helmsley and Steve Austin. So the two-man power trip some almost 5 years before that whole thing would take place. There is also a clip of Bret Hart's interview from the previous Monday's Raw, the one where he said he would be staying with the WWF, but much more concerned with him revealing who his opponent would be for the Survivor Series, where he said he would face the best wrestler in the WWF, Stone Cold Steve Austin. And they show Austin watching it on a TV backstage, of course, at the proper three-quarters perspective, because nobody watches TV like an actual human being in WWF or WWE to this day. So he sees this, he has no real reaction to it, but Brian Pillman is there with Austin, who they are still somewhat buddy-buddy, and they're certainly linked within this promotion. And Pillman is very excited about this. And he was kind of aligning himself with Owen Hart, saying, we're going to bring Bret back, but one of those things where it was clear that they really had no actual influence in getting it done. But he gets really excited and cheers that Bret is coming back. And Austin turns and shoots him a look that was so in line with his character. Like, what the hell are you doing? But what I really liked about that scene is it's not just the two of them there watching. For whatever reason, T.L. Hopper, the dirty white boy Tony Anthony, is just standing there watching on. They should do more of that. Just have random people standing in the background of stuff. You know, make it more realistic that it's not just those two guys watching the random TV in the back. Our hosts for Superstars are Jim Ross and Mr. Perfect. And this is also kind of an odd team. I mentioned the heel versus heel match with Hunter and Austin. This is a sort of all-heel commentary team, which, again, not something that you would see a lot of, because JR is coming off that fake Razor and fake Diesel thing. That was about a month before this, and Mr. Perfect, having just turned the previous Monday to join Hunter Hearst Helmsley to become his manager, but more on that in a little bit. He would be suspended from wrestling by Gorilla Monsoon, and there's also more to that as well. The only other time I can think of where you have two heel commentators just kind of thinking about it was, I recall that there's some sort of Maple Leaf Wrestling, or there was some show that was called by Don Morocco and Jake Roberts, and I may have to check on something like that, but Ross would kind of return to normal after a while, although they were doing that thing where they would screw with him by having his equipment fail. Like, we can't hear JR because his headset's not working, technical difficulties. And Vince would just rib the hell out of JR, saying, well, I don't know, you're a producer on the show, pal, you know, stuff like that. So for our first match, we have two named teams here, the Smoking Guns, Billy and Bart, taking on the New Rockers of Marty Jannetty and Leaf Cassidy. And while Al Snow might have felt ridiculous being a character named Leaf Cassidy, I can assure you that Marty Jannetty is the more ridiculous one in this team, at least on this day, which I'll get to as we get into the match. And in just kind of watching this, without having done a lot of prior research on these two teams, I have no idea who the heel is in this match either. I don't know if they're both heels, both babyfaces, but as I recall, the New Rockers were probably both heels. And Vince, always obsessed with Billy Gunn. Guy would stick around forever and they'd try at various points, 1999 being one of the more infamous ones, but them also getting a tag title run at the beginning of 2014 seems a little strange in retrospect. I guess he was a good tag team wrestler. I mean, you have to be in order to have that kind of longevity. But I'm much more interested in him for a different reason, which is that his actual real-life name is Monty Sopp. Now, I don't know if you knew that and why you would go with a name like Billy Gunn. You call yourself Mr. Ass, and when that's an actual improvement over your real-life name, it is kind of sad. But Monty Sopp, in my own mind, is immortalized for one reason, which was a quote-unquote rib played on my friend Jeff by his pals at the George Washington University. I had nothing to do with this, and I was impressed by the creativity that went into it. and how this actually goes back to Billy Gunn, where Jeff, he was a little too interested in space policy, you know, like NASA, and would talk about it at great length. So they made up this press release using, you know, one of those websites where you can just, you know, make anything look authentic. And this was back in like 05. There was something online where you could put together a press release and it would look authentic. And it was Jeff Federico named Space Policy Advocate of the Year, and they made up some organization that presented this award for him and made up this backstory that he had an appearance on the talk show All Things Considered on NPR to discuss the implications of the nomination of Justice Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court on space policy in the United States. When they tried to get a Wikipedia page for Jeff, it was up there for not very long. And in fact, one of the comments said that when your primary claim to fame is your lone interview on All Things Considered, you're not notable. Fellas should come back in 10 years and try again. So it was immediately deleted. Well, anyway, that press release said it was written by Monty Sopp, which is a nice pen name to use. Also, I think, a pretty good name to use on a message board. And while I'm obsessed with good old Monty, at this particular point in time, the story with him is that they had lost the tag team titles back in September to Owen Hart and the British Bulldog. And Billy, they had been dropped, the Smoking Guns, by Sonny because she would only manage the tag team champions. And Billy was very upset with this because he wanted Sonny in their corner. Bart really didn't seem to care about this at all. But, you know, this was kind of costing them matches, his obsession with Sonny and all that. And there was some tension building up between these two, which is notable, I guess, in the sense that they were probably the number one team in the WWF over the previous 3 to 4 years, simply for the fact that they were there the entire time. Now, Bart and Leaf start out this match. They're trading hammerlocks. JR is busy running down what is going to be on the show. But Mr. Perfect, he's very kind of PO'd at Gorilla. As I mentioned, JR is still a bit of a heel, so they're kind of finding common ground a bit.
And we'll be able to tell that story about the perfect hoax that was pulled off by Hunter Helmsley and Mr. Perfect.
That really embarrassed Monsoon, I can tell you that.
Personally, I think the man's taking it personal. Otherwise, why would he revoke my license, JR? Come on.
That's just the way Monsoon is. I've said all along that I think he's inept.
Wow, if you think Gorilla was inept as WWF president back in the day, you should check out that guy who occasionally calls New Japan matches on AXS, because he's pretty bad. He doesn't really even seem to know what's going on in the promotion, and yet he's out there front and center. Anyway, Bart Gunn, he kind of has negative charisma. I'm not entirely sure what the point of Bart Gunn is. I don't know why he exists. So he tags out to Billy Gunn, who then promptly gets arm dragged. So the two of them start to argue, and you just hate to see that. And immediately they cut to Sonny backstage, of course, watching at the proper three-quarters angle, forever looking for something or someone to do. But honestly, it's rather interesting what the direction was with Sonny, because she's red hot through 95 into 96. She's paired with Farouk. That fizzles out before this. She's no longer with the Smoking Guns, so she really doesn't have a role going forward. In fact, even Chris Candido, her boyfriend, had gone to ECW because he pretty much had gotten sick of what WWF was feeding him at that point. But they do get some thoughts from Sonny on the situation with the Guns.
Billy Gunn just can't take no for answer. See, Billy Gunn can't get it through his thick skull that he is no longer a part of my life. Let y'all in on a little secret, okay? As a tag team, the Smoking Guns are losers. They're nothing. Three strikes, and I'm out of the tag team division. But Billy has shown some initiative, and there's always room for reconciliation if Billy was ever to become a single. Never say never in the World Wrestling Federation.
He won't take no for an answer. Is Billy Gunn Matt Lauer? Because I've never seen the two of them in the same place. So Marty Jannetty, and I need to say a few words about him, because in this new Rockers era, which, by the way, they have the same music as the old Rockers, which, I don't know, I guess Jim Johnson didn't really feel like writing new music for them. They got, like, the weird X thing, which makes it look like they're proto-DX, at least on, like, the singlet. But Marty, wearing the singlet, with the tights that stop before the knee, not wearing knee pads, which is a little strange, considering usually a guy who's a high flyer like that, it makes Jannetty look like something out of 1974. And due to his various issues, he wouldn't even see 1997. He'd be gone before that point. There's a blind tag made by Billy to Bart, who gets kicked as he steps into the ring. So more arguing between the two guns. And I'm just in tears at this point. I can barely take notes because the tears from my eyes at the smoking guns and the dissension is just getting all over my notebook. I maybe should start typing it on a computer. But then again, it would get all over the keyboard and I might end up doing damage that way. Although I should probably just get a new laptop at this point. And that would be a nice excuse. But I really feel weird, you know, crying about the smoking guns. But the Rockers take it, excuse me, the new Rockers, because the only way these resemble the old Rockers is it's a really weird-looking Marty Jannetty that we got. And Billy Gunn just storms off. He heads for the locker room. He screws, so now it is Bart Gunn against the new Rockers in a handicap match. Now, I don't really care what happens to Bart Gunn, the vacuum of charisma that he is, as he gets kind of worked over in there by Leaf Cassidy, and they go to an ad break. I'm like, is Billy going to return? I'm not sure I care all that much, despite all my tears that I have shed just a few moments ago. Marty misses the SD Jones Memorial Charge, which is apropos considering that he's at about SD Jones levels now, and he's also not wearing knee pads like SD Jones. But when he misses on that, Leaf takes the opportunity to run down the apron and clothesline Bart to maintain the advantage. And Marty is kind of preening opposite to the hard camera, which is another reason maybe to fire him or send him back to NXT for 3 or 4 years because he doesn't know what he is doing. And I know that I spent 4 minutes complaining about the Jeffrey Mayer play and the Yankees, but JR on commentary, because this did air on Sunday morning, October 27th, 1996, talks about the recent World Series involving the Yankees. And it's kind of funny in that it's a bit of a shots fired moment at WCW, very obliquely.
Well, the New York Yankees certainly pulled it off last night. The Yankees, the world champions of Major League Baseball, and to our friends down in Atlanta, it's the same old story. New York wins. New York wins. New York will always win.
Was there any doubt in your mind, JR?
Well, not really.
For someone who connects baseball and pro wrestling the way that I do, I've never thought of those Braves-Yankees World Series of the late 90s in that way and kind of compared it to how the Monday Night Wars ended up going. Because in that 96 World Series, the Braves won the first two games in New York. And Andrew Jones had a couple of big games at the start of that series as a 19-year-old. But kind of interesting, you think of it as like the NWO, they jump out to this lead, and then the WWF comes storming back. The Yankees win the last four games in that series, and then by 1999, the Yankees swept the Braves in that World Series. And you think of pro wrestling in that landscape in 1999 and how WCW just trended straight downhill. WWF, obviously not a very watchable product, I've said that many times, but in terms of ratings and all the metrics, they were certainly trending upward, certainly vis-a-vis their opponents. Marty and Leaf lift Bart up for a double suplex, but instead of taking him over on the straight vertical, they just kind of dump him on the top rope. And Marty with an Irish whip and a knee to the gut of Bart Gunn. And then he does a very strange prance. And I need to remember to make a GIF file of this because I don't know how to describe this other than to say that it looks like Marty Jannetty is tripping balls in front of a audience of a couple of thousand people. It was not natural, but then again, Marty Jannetty, I don't think ever struck me as a natural sort of heel, but I'm not going to say that he was inebriated or anything, because that certainly does not sound like the Marty Jannetty that I know. Leaf Cassidy gets in, Irish whip goes for the same move, but then it gets countered into a flash roll-up, and wouldn't you know it, Bart Gunn picks up the 1-2-3. He beats both the in a one-on-two situation, Bart Gunn defeats the new Rockers, and I'm just like, what the hell is this? I mean, he could have easily been sacrificed for the angle that was happening, and given the new Rockers a win, it's not like they were going to go anywhere, but they look like complete chumps. That they are just completely finished. Did he really need to go over? Did Bart Gunn really need to win this? It's like the Brawl for all over again, but, you know, a couple of years before this. It's just dumb, dumb, dumb. It's like having a wrestler boxing shoot match in the first place and doing that idea. And what happens with the smoking guns down the line? Well, not too long after this, Billy and Bart would have a match, and Billy would suffer a stinger in the match, which to me it's unclear whether he was hurt, because he was kept off TV for a while and it kind of cut that feud short. You wouldn't really see Bart Gunn at all until he emerges in the new Midnight Express as Bodacious Bart alongside Bombastic Bob Holly. Because it's completely ridiculous that they had to give them nicknames like that that weren't organic, like Beautiful Bobby, Loverboy, Dennis Condrey, stuff like that. Billy Gunn would eventually return sometime in the spring of 1997 as the awaited protege of the Honky Tonk Man, because he had been looking for one around the WWF, and he settled on Billy Gunn as Rockabilly, which, while it was not a good thing for him during the course of that year, as long as that led to the New Age Outlaws, eventually him teaming up with the Road Dogg, because they had a shared interest in failed musical gimmicks, they had something in common like that. From that perspective, I think it meets the criteria of, well, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn, right?
Dellenby breaks for the net. Messier, a shot!
The backhand on the rebound with a shot that didn't get through.
You know, things were pretty bleak for my Boston Bruins from the mid-90s all the way to probably about 2000, 2001, I want to say, where things started to turn around at least a little bit for a short period, to the point where Ray Bourque scoring the game-winning goal in an all-star game held in Boston, which I didn't go to. This was before I had season tickets, and I'm glad that they don't host an all-star game while I do, because I wouldn't even want to buy tickets. I would want to go to the skills event the night before, because it's a lot more fun. But that game, more memorable for the infamous Fox Glow Puck, or the Fox Tracks, that debuted on that telecast. And a lot of people ripped that, but honestly, I think it was a pretty good idea. It didn't really work out in practice, because the little light that would follow the puck was, you know, sometimes it would screw up and it would be in the wrong place. But I think it was an innovative way in the era before HDTV to help people watch hockey on television. HD did end up solving a lot of problems for the NHL in due time, and I remember when I got my first HD box and watching a hockey game, I realized at that point I couldn't go back anymore. I mean, football's a little different. You can tell what's going on. The picture quality is not as important, and in hockey, in terms to follow the game, it was certainly something that really helped the presentation of the product on television. So there's a flashback to the In Your House Buried Alive pay-per-view, where your main event was Mankind versus The Undertaker in a Buried Alive match. This is the one where the Executioner shows up, and after Mankind is buried, pulls him out, and they throw The Undertaker in the grave. Which, by the way, the one where it kind of makes it sound like a Friends episode, but it was anything but that. And there were a lot of different executioners in the WWF. There's Jack Evans at one time, Buddy Rose famously under a mask at WrestleMania 1 in the opening bout. This one, of course, Terry Gordy in what can only be described, to once again bring baseball into this, as a Willie Mays for the Mets in 1973 kind of situation. And what that means is this was well past the sell-by date for Terry Gordy. The milk had definitely turned sour. I mean, the guy had had a stroke. I was pointing this out in a Smoky Mountain show from 1994, and this is more than 2 years after that. it's definitely not something that's fun to see. Like, oh, Terry Gordy returns to the WWF after 12 years. Now, albeit he's under a hood. But it's like watching Brett Favre in his second season with the Vikings, where he's laid out unconscious on a cart being, you know, taken off the Gillette Stadium field. It's just not the same at all. But of course, Mankind and The Undertaker, it didn't detract from that feud, which was certainly The Undertaker's best to that point. Even though sometimes they would do cheesy stuff with the lightning, which I think you could get away with The Undertaker more than any other character because of the whole supernatural aspect. But this one is kind of funny in that, yes, they bury The Undertaker in there, but at the end, the dramatic image of The Undertaker's hand reaching up through the ground to let everybody know he's going to be okay, folks.
How do I get the hand?
We all want the hand. Hand is tough to get.
I've got a hand.
And you're going to need it.
That was the whole key to the streak. The Undertaker had hand. That's why, you know, they're so interested in the glove that he wore at WrestleMania 13. When you have hand, people are looking at what kind of gloves you might be wearing. And you don't win 22 in a row without hand. All the great ones had hand. Bruno, he had hand. Hulk Hogan, he had hand. Everybody, including the next guy who they are playing vignettes for, although it actually took him a while to get hand.
My grandfather was High Chief Peter Maivia.
Look at Peter Maivia go!
My father is Rocky Johnson.
Rocky Johnson making it pay!
So out of respect and honor, from this day forward, I will be known as Rocky Maivia.
Meet Rocky Maivia, the Samoan sensation following his family heritage right into the WWF.
So Rocky, with your incredible family background as a third generation superstar here in the World Wrestling Federation, the first ever, I know there's probably some big shoes to fill.
And the big platter from Samoa coming on strong out.
To be honest with you, I really don't feel that much pressured or anything like that.
The Rock getting a big ovation.
We talk about tradition, we talk about long lines of tradition and heritage, and that's what you have in my bloodlines and in my family.
That family includes Grandpa, a legendary Samoan Paramount High Chief, and Dad, a former WWF Tag Team Champion. So Rocky's been around wrestling all his life.
And who's that young man?
That's me. I'm there with my mother and my grandmother. We're watching this match with my grandfather, wrestling Harley Race for the NWA World title in New Zealand. Even as I watch the match now, I see my grandfather's intensity and his aggressiveness, and those are two traits I know I've inherited from him.
And that's not all Rocky inherited from his grandfather.
As a young man in lineage, you had the opportunity to be a high chief, and you turned it down.
For one, I didn't feel worthy, only because I had not lived in Samoa for a lengthy period of time. At that time, I really didn't want to leave, and to this moment, I still do not want to leave. There's a lot of things I want to do over here in the United States and America, and competing in the World Wrestling Federation is one of them.
So Rocky's just about set to continue the family legacy, but he's not looking for any special treatment.
I would never attempt to follow in my father's footsteps or my grandfather's footsteps because they're too big to follow in to begin with. I signed a very basic, minimum, no-guarantee rookie contract. And everything I give, I'm going to work for, and it will be earned.
Next week, a look back at Rocky's storied football career.
It was after this play that Charlie decided he didn't want to play football anymore, and that's when he signed with the Knicks.
There are so many things that I love about this Rocky Maivia vignette to introduce him leading up to his debut at the Survivor Series. First of all, how friendly he is with Kevin Kelly during this, because Kevin Kelly would be a frequent subject of abuse by The Rock when he would take on that cocky heel or even cocky babyface persona later on. And he's just chatting with him, humble as ever. It's a different side of him. Of course, that's not what people wanted at the time, but that's beside the point. It's just fun to look back and see that. They showed the clip of him in the audience watching. They said his grandfather, which is entirely possible because I would date it to the late 70s based on how old he looked. There's another match where you see him in the audience in Allentown, actually. It's a championship wrestling episode from March of 84, when his dad and Tony Atlas, the Soul Patrol, who famously did not get along with each other, and he is in the audience watching, and the camera lingers on him for quite a while. I want to say that's the March 24th, 1984 episode of Championship Wrestling. I don't think it's on YouTube anymore. I hope I pulled that episode down and saved it, because I wanted to do that, saying, this is the episode of Championship Wrestling that the Breakfast Club missed, because that's the date that they were all in detention. They show him sacking Charlie Ward at the end of it as a player for the University of Miami, and Charlie Ward, quarterback at Florida State, win the Heisman Trophy in 1993. As I watched him sack Charlie Ward, I thought, well, that's roughing the passer in the NFL, because he landed on him with all of his body weight. That'd be a 15-yard penalty. Maybe not in college. I don't know about the differences in roughing the passer between the NFL and college. But think about this. He only would become, I guess, arguably the most famous pro wrestler of all time. I say that he is, just for the fact that he is an internationally known actor. And he had the best overall career of any wrestler, because he's up there in that top five in terms of drawing money. But most importantly, he was not a prisoner of the business. He parlayed it into the dream of being an actor, where, you know, it's a lot easier on his body, quite frankly. I mean, he comes back for WrestleMania 29 and tears all sorts of muscles, which is why I don't think you'll ever see him come back, because it's just so costly to insure him. And he's too smart to do a match in Saudi Arabia because of what that would represent from a PR perspective. But God love this guy. I mean, the fact that where he started out from the humble beginnings, and then the whole Rocky Sucks thing, which, by the way, could have turned sideways had they not done the audible and do the things that they did, turn him heel, put him in the Nation, put him under the guidance of somebody like Ron Simmons, who I think had an impact on his career going forward, even beyond the angle that they would do where he becomes the ruler of the Nation in the spring of 1998. It does kind of make me wish that I did more episodes in The Rock's era. So that would basically be from Survivor Series 96 all the way up to 2003. I mean, I've only covered him on a couple of occasions. The Shotgun from 99, the other show that I did in 2001, what was it, WWF Metal, or whatever the hell it was. I mean, it doesn't really matter. So I just don't get to talk about The Rock as frequently as I might like, because while I loved Austin at the time, there came a point where I did certainly grow tired of him, and him and Rocky kind of crossed in my own mind eye. It was probably sometime in the middle of summer of 1998, and I'm probably not alone in that regard. Actually, I know one way of solving that problem where I don't get to talk about The Rock enough. I could go over to ProWrestlingOnly.com and explore other podcasts and match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows and movies. I think that's right up The Rock's alley, and much more. Join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade, and with over 2,000 registered members in an archive of 2.8 million threads. The message board is a vibrant community on its own. Whether you want to talk about a specific match, not just a Rock match, but any match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the Microscope forum, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of it out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
By Ninja.
Unstoppable.
Testo.
Uncontrollable.
Cyber Fist.
Unbelievable.
Tiger Ninja.
Incomparable.
And now, the Milton Bradley Karate Fighters Holiday Tournament.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first annual Milton Bradley Karate Fighters Holiday Tournament pregame pairing and selection show. Just who will be crowned the greatest karate fighter of them all?
I still can't believe I'm not in the tournament.
This Karate Fighters Tournament thing is something that if I was just watching these and not doing a podcast, I would probably fast forward through them because I wouldn't have a great interest. But I am doing a podcast, so I am very interested in these little things, because I kind of want to break down the matchups that they have for this first annual tournament, which they kind of have an embedded joke in this whole thing by saying that Lawler is banned from the tournament for something he did the year before in terms of cheating, even though this is the first annual tournament. So I kind of funny how they do that. So the first round matchups include Sonny facing off against Mr. Bob Backlund. And I gotta say, I'm going to make Sunny the favorite in that one because she's very good with her wrists, if you know what I mean. Sable is taking on Doc Hendricks, and somehow they will both lose in that one, or it's at least my projection. And then another first-round match, and I don't know why this one makes me laugh, but it is Sid taking on Marlena. What a matchup that is. And finally, I get my Sid versus the York Foundation feud that I did not get in 1991 WCW. Final one is Mr. Perfect versus Phineas Godwin, which seems like a real mismatch to me, because Mr. Perfect would obviously be very good at Karate Fighters since he's very good at everything else. And they do an impromptu matchup where Lawler ends up beating Todd Pettengill in this, and kind of makes me wonder with these Karate Fighters, like, how do you work these things in terms of, do you just tape matches and then, you know, continue doing them until you get the result you want? I mean, I figure you'd have to do it that way, because I never had Rock'em Sock'em Robots or any toys like this. So it's something that I'm not really experienced in that realm at all.
But there's two things that Shawn Michaels will never, ever be. He will never, ever be as tough as me. And he will never, ever be as smart as me. I think Richard Nixon said it best. You learn from defeat, and you come back and you beat him the next time.
What a weird thing to be quoting Richard Nixon on a wrestling program in 1996. I mean, I appreciate it and all. You just picture him on Montreal. This is not a work, or something like that. But Brett, always kind of unique in his own way. This is the interview where he accepts the challenge of Steve Austin, the best wrestler in the WWF. And Austin is like, what? And the dirty white boy is standing there. Which I cannot get enough of the fact that he just happens to be standing there. But there's also another line in here that he mentioned Shawn Michaels and how I'm going to come back and I'm going to beat him. Which, by the way, for Nixon, it only worked in that he got a different opponent in Hubert H. Humphrey. So kind of funny. That means Nixon comes back and he goes over Triple H in the 68 election. But that's either here nor there. So the Brett and Shawn thing, they're not at each other's throats. Brett's not tearing his hair out backstage at Monday Night Raw or anything like that. But he does throw in one little cheap shot at Shawn.
Hey, I can't dance. And I don't pose too well for girly books.
Yeah, Shawn Michaels posed in Playgirl, but I think he's got a misunderstanding of what that is, because that's really more for gay men than it is for girls, at least as the way I understand it, anyway. So that's ramping up, but that's in the future, because we're going to worry about Brett and Steve Austin first. And to be honest, Brett, who was gone since WrestleMania, with the exception of some foreign tours, there was a match on the network that was a Bret Hart Dungeon Collection. I don't know if it's still there or if they took it away on the award-winning WWE Network, that featured a Bret Hart match in South Africa against Stone Cold Steve Austin from September of 1996. So one of those rare matches that he was in. And by the way, Owen Hart is on color for that match, and he was actually very good and very funny at it, which probably no surprise. But Bret really needed that break away, not only to kind of refresh and to let people miss him a bit, but also to, you know, let Shawn Michaels sink or swim on his own. Even if the product did suffer for much of 1996 as Monday Night Raw, not exactly compelling for much of that time, because it took a while to realize that Steve Austin was somebody that should be a little bit more front and center. This wasn't like Hulk Hogan in 1990 where, yeah, he gets injured by Earthquake at the end of May, but then he's right back on television at the beginning of July. So it's only like a month and a half that he's gone. Brett's gone for at least 6 months, 8 months, as it were. So it allowed that time for Shawn Michaels to be what he would become as champion. And yes, Brett certainly needed some time away exploring all those acting options. But, you know, not everybody is going to have it like The Rock, where it's going to turn into that full-time thing where they won't have to beat themselves up and become a prisoner of the wrestling business.
Go ahead, David.
I wish to say that we all look forward with great pleasure to 4 years of wonderful, inspiring speeches, full of wit, poetry, music, love, and affection. Plus more goddamn nonsense than has ever been. The other is that...
You can't say that on the air, Mr. Brinkley.
Well, I'm not on the air.
Ah, but David Brinkley was on the air on election night 1996 as Bill Clinton was reelected as President of the United States. I know it's a non-sports moment, but it was so funny, and I remember watching it at the time. He also said that Clinton was a goddamn bore. In addition to all that, plus more goddamn nonsense. David Brinkley... He retired in 1997. He looked a lot like my grandfather, so I kind of looked to him as like my TV news grandpa, and he really kind of didn't give a crap, especially, you know, as the acerbic host of This Week with David Brinkley. And you don't really think of him as much as other TV journalists. You know, Walter Cronkite gets all the headlines, and you think of him first from that era. But this also gives me a cheap excuse to play the clip of Phil Hartman from Saturday Night Live. In 1988, they did a presidential debate skit with George H.W. Bush and Mike Dukakis, John Lovitz as Dukakis, and of course Dana Carvey as Bush 41, where they're doing post-debate analysis with Tom Hanks doing a fantastic Peter Jennings and Phil Hartman doing a perfect David Brinkley.
Well, what we saw were two men doing everything they could to avoid saying what they would do if elected. Because they know if they did, we wouldn't elect them. But that's nothing new, of course, Peter. Every president from Washington to Ronald Reagan has been either a liar or a fool, and usually both.
Well, David, throughout your career, you've been known for your cynicism, but certainly that you haven't lost that much faith in the presidency.
Well, Peter, as I get older, I find I've lost faith in a good many things. Country, family, religion, the love of a man for a woman. I've reached a point where it's a struggle just to get up in the morning, to continue to plod through a dreary, nasty, brutal life of terrible desperation, at the end of which we're all just food for maggots.
Food for maggots, indeed. Well, thank you, David.
I really can't stop laughing at that. Food for maggots, indeed. Thank you, David. Coming up next, we have the Godwins taking on John Faulkner and William Diamond, which sounds like two classics authors or something like that. I don't know. But being a hillbilly in WWE certainly, and I stated this before, it certainly has its privileges because you can go out there and make a bunch of money for a little while and still be as bad at pro wrestling as Uncle Elmer, Cousin Junior, Cousin Luke, the whole lot of them. I mean, they come over, they're Tex Slasinger and Shanghai Pierce at WCW, they're favorites of the center stage crowd. And they come in here, oh, well, why would you want to be hillbillies? Because when you're a hillbilly, you instantly get Vince McMahon's attention. There's only one problem with it, though, and it's that the business was kind of moving away from hillbillies being uber popular in any sort of way. And Vince is clearly, he's not on commentary for this show. And you kind of lose something with regard to those hillbilly characters when Vince McMahon isn't around because you don't get the big uproarious laugh. And JR just isn't going to view it the same way as old Vinnie Mac. And they start out with some slow arm work as JR and Mr. Perfect are hyping Austin versus Bret Hart coming at the Survivor Series. Is Ross brags about getting an interview with Bret Hart out in Calgary, which, you know, says that he's the real commentator in the WWF, but, you know, just kind of alluding to that heel character he has. As this match is going on, they go to the back where Owen Hart and the British Bulldog are standing by with Clarence Mason, their attorney, and they had lost previously to the Godwins in a non-title match on television. I believe they said it was on the Superstars show. So we're setting that up for the Godwins to be gunning for those tag team titles.
Well, you know, the Godwins, I'll give them credit. They're a tough, big, rugged team, but they're still big, stupid hillbillies, and they lucked out. They got a lucky
ball. Yeah, they got a pretty great slam for
Bulldog, but we get a rematch with them. We're fighting champions. We'll give another shot, and we'll beat them.
Yes, that's right. In the middle of that promo, you actually heard the bell ring because it hit the slop drop and finished off the opponent while the promo was going on. It seems like something was screwed up there in that the WWF usually smart enough to let the promo happen, maybe give it another minute when they cut back to the ring, then they hit their finisher, everything's all set. But they even let Bulldog speak for a little bit, so it's really strange. The hillbillies are dancing in the ring, but it's just not the same without Vince McMahon there on commentary to give us the uproarious laughter that we need. They wouldn't win the tag team titles from Owen and Bulldog, and it would take them a year. It would be October of 1997 at In Your House Bad Blood that they would finally regain those tag team titles, beating the Headbangers at that pay-per-view. So right now I'm going to declare something. I could call it a rule, but I don't want to, you know, sound like Bill Maher or anything like that. I'll call it Godwin's Law. And this is not to be confused with the Godwin's Law that refers to Hitler being brought up in any internet thread. This is Godwin's with two N's. Godwin's Law, two N's, is if Vince McMahon is taking an interest in you and laughing at what you're doing on television, then everything is going to be okay in the end, so long as that is happening.
The Hall of Fame is just part of the Survivor Series weekend. And for ticket information, call Ticketmaster at 212-307-7171.
I know that the Hall of Fame was moved to WrestleMania weekend, starting with WrestleMania 20, but I think it might actually be a decent idea to move it to a different pay-per-view to kind of increase interest in that show. Now, I know you got people coming in for the Hall of Fame and, you know, with WrestleMania, and, you know, people want to go to both, but if you say move it to SummerSlam weekend or Survivor Series weekend like it was in 1996, you know, you can kind of spread things out in that way. Maybe not the Royal Rumble, because you probably don't want to have it in the dead of winter, but I do think that's a good idea. Now, the ticket information line. You know what I have to do. I have to call that number and find out what happens.
Welcome to Verizon Wireless. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the number and dial again. Announcement for Welcome to Verizon Wireless. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the number and dial again. Announcement for
Oh, that's a bummer. I had my expectations maybe a little too high after my call to Caesars to try to get WrestleMania 9 tickets a few weeks ago. Now, WWE Hall of Fame gets some criticism for, well, I don't think this person should be in the Hall of Fame or whatever, but they have their own standards, their own way, and at least they don't have Chris Benoit in it like the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, which just had their voting for this year and a lot of consternation about all that. Though it does have its own murderers and racists in there. And in fact, one of them was inducted in 1996. Try to guess which one. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. The inductees for 1996 were Pat Patterson, who did not have a long run in the WWF as an active wrestler because he comes in 79. And by the time, you know, the end of 1981 with the Mosca feud, you know, when that winds down, Patterson really isn't in the ring all that much. And then he makes spot appearances from that point forward. But everything that he did was very high impact. The Mosca feud with the water pitcher, Slaughter, the match at the alley fight at Madison Square Garden, the Backlund feud, which featured four matches at Madison Square Garden, which nobody else ever got four matches with the champ there, and being the first Intercontinental Champion, all that. So as a pure builder of the WWF, as a front office guy, man who developed the Royal Rumble, certainly more than deserving of it. Jimmy Snuka, well, you know, there's that whole unpleasantness, but he would be put into a match at the Survivor Series for whatever reason at the age of 53, although he was ECW champion a little bit earlier in the 90s, and he certainly did have a huge impact from the point in which he came in 1982 up to the unpleasantness in 1983, where it became clear that it was not, he was not somebody that could be relied on, even though the big moment where he jumps off the cage against Morocco happens in October of that year. And Vincent J. McMahon, it's kind of strange how it took several turns before he's actually inducted by his son, because let's face it, Vince Jr. is who's making the decisions here. And this is held at the Marriott Marquis Hotel. This is not held at MSG. It's not held at the Paramount Theater or the Felt Forum or whatever you want to call it. There is a thought that maybe they need to change the Hall of Fame because the ceremony is never ending. Maybe move it to a smaller venue. But there's money to be made, clearly, and they're not going to be given any of it back. I think it might be a decent idea to kind of spread the love and add importance to, I don't know, another pay-per-view. But obviously, WrestleMania is their biggest weekend. They're going to move all the chips to the center. And if you're inviting somebody to a different pay-per-view to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think part of the appeal of saying yes, at least for those guys who have turned them down or gals who turned them down over the years, I mean, well, I get to be on WrestleMania, if that holds any sort of distinction for them. But personally, if they moved it to another pay-per-view, I certainly wouldn't be heartbroken because there's so much going on WrestleMania weekend anyway. You can shift it somewhere else and it'll mean just as much.
I'd like to bring out a very special guest right now, a close friend and the 1996 King of the Ring winner, Stone Cold Steve Austin.
And so begins what is truly the last great angle in the history of WWF superstars. It started out as the Superstars of Wrestling in September of 1986. That first great angle was probably Piper's Pit versus the Flower Shop, which was carryover from Championship Wrestling and something that I covered in depth in the first episode of Greetings from Allentown. And then so many of them through the years, because until Raw comes along in 1993, it is the Undisputed A Show. But now in 1996, it's falling out of favor within syndication. It's being put on the USA Network on Sunday mornings. It's really a shell of its former self and becomes effectively a recap show when you start 1997, except for international editions, which might have had first-run matches. But so I'm just going to call this the last great Superstars angle that there ever was. And Pillman hosting the interview segment, because they were always looking for things for him to do, because he's severely injured when he comes in. He has the car accident, and he really has extremely limited mobility, and that'll feed into the reason for why this angle took place. But Pillman's character, I've expressed great appreciation for the Loose Cannon character to the point where if I could be any character in the history of professional wrestling, 1996 Brian Pillman is what I would want to be, except I'm not sure I would show the same commitment to the whole bit that he did, where a lot of like research was put into it and the psychology and how to work that. And a lot of that info comes from the book Crazy Like a Fox, which is something that I can't recommend highly enough. The Brian Pillman book that came out either earlier in 2018 or came out in 2017. It is fairly recent and it is quite an interesting read. The image that he's cultivating is, I don't know why it is cool. It might be kind of a, it's not really a grunge thing. I think maybe it's just the fact that he's so unpredictable, but he's wearing a shirt with Marilyn Monroe's face on it. It's the way he stands out and is different from everybody else. And for that matter, Stone Cold Steve Austin in 1996, certainly different from everybody else with how misanthropic he was. And while the King of the Ring was a huge moment for him and the Austin 316 and the t-shirt business probably doesn't get started in earnest without the Austin 316 line, he doesn't really get going during the summer because he's doing a lot of his work on Superstars. He's not getting on Raw every week. He's on the freaking SummerSlam free-for-all in a bizarre match against Yokozuna that he wins in about a minute 40 when Yokozuna falls off the ropes trying to do the Banzai Splash. So it took a while for things to get going, for them to understand what they had with him. There's an episode of Raw from middle of July of 96. I believe it was the episode after the In Your House International incident where Austin joins the commentary desk. And this was something that was invaluable for him to show some of this personality, the misanthropic nature, like I was saying, because he wasn't getting as many chances before that. I said he's on Superstars quite a bit, to the point where Steve Austin might also be the last superstar created using the show Superstars. And then factor in all the previous history with Pillman and Austin, who were, of course, very tight in real life. Their fates were kind of intertwined in WCW when it came to contract negotiations and all that sort of stuff. And the book does go into that. So it's nice that they're able to work this angle together. Unfortunately, though, it's not for the greatest reasons in the world because of Pillman actually being hurt. But Pillman, in this story, he's very excited that Bret Hart is coming back. Because while Pillman is not Canadian, he did play in the Canadian Football League, which is how you kind of get him into the Hart Foundation. He worked in Stampede Wrestling. He's a tag team partner of Bruce Hart at one time. So he's very interconnected with all of that. But he's also friends with Austin as well. So he's kind of got that balancing act in the middle of it. So he's very excited that Bret's coming back. But Austin, very true to his character in just hating everything, very Bad News Brownish. Except Austin, maybe you could do business with him more than a Bad News Brown. Austin isn't exactly fond of Pillman's attitude towards this whole thing.
To prove yourself, I sure as hell saw how excited you were when you jumped out of your chair like some kind of cheerleader. Now don't even start talking yet because I ain't through, son. Then you went out there and you shook his hand. It ain't time to start kissing up to Bret Hart yet, because he ain't yet lived up to the biggest challenge of his life. And shut up. I ain't never had to prove myself to nobody.
So what Austin is saying with that double negative, and yes, I am going to be that guy and be a grammar stickler, is that he has had to prove himself to somebody. But okay, I'll leave that alone. With my Simpsons addled mind, I'm thinking of this in terms of that episode where Bart and Milhouse become divided by that girl that Milhouse falls for, the girl with the braces who moved into town because of Springfield's high crime rate and her dad was like sold security systems and stuff. So in this case, Bart would be Steve Austin, Milhouse would be Brian Pillman, and the girl with braces would be Bret Hart.
And you can listen to me, you little crippled freak.
Hey, come on.
Everybody knows that at one time I carried you to a world championship. Everybody knows at one time you rode in my back pocket.
Wow.
Madison Square Garden, Bret Hart. You're going to find out. Bret Hart's going to find out. The whole damn world's going to find out. I will do exactly what I say. I am going to whip his ass.
Well, this is Sunday morning on the USA Network, and in 1996, things were a little bit more strict, so you're not going to say ass on TV, so we're going to bleep that out. You'd only get the chance to hear Austin say ass on TV on that same channel about 50,000 more times before the decade was out. The reference to the Hollywood Blondes is certainly interesting. It's a very subtle allusion. They don't mention the name of the team, but it certainly is a nod to people who understood where Steve Austin and Brian Pillman came from and their shared history, which is something that I certainly endorse when you're telling a story because, yeah, you're talking to your fans who are just WWF fans, but you're also talking to an audience that watches all kinds of wrestling, and it's nice to, you know, kind of work in that stuff, especially for somebody like me who likes to carry over storylines over a number of years and cross promotions and stuff.
Well, there you have it. Austin versus the best there was. The best there is, and the best there was.
Hey, wait a minute.
Wow.
What a cheap shot by...
Austin didn't want to hear that.
Austin with a cheap shot on Brian Pillman. Pillman, it's a
just getting assaulted here by Austin. Austin stomping away at the cripple Brian Pillman.
Oh, no.
Oh, oh my God. Austin just broke that chain right across Pillman's ankle. And now he's Austin stomping away. Austin may have, he may have re-broken Pillman's ankle here.
Well, you got to respect Stone Cold Steve Austin. Look at this guy. You know, I love this style. JR, I love this style. I love exactly what he's doing. Take it to him.
But perfect. Pillman's a cripple man.
I don't care who he is.
He can't defend himself.
I don't care. Then get out of wrestling if you can't defend yourself. It's the World Wrestling Federation. Either shut up or put up or do something.
Austin's like an animal here.
Oh, wait a minute.
Pillman's ankle.
I mean, this is all pretty famous to the point where what Austin does to Pillman is known as Pillmanizing. They actually named what he did in this, wherein he takes the folding chair, wraps it around Pillman's ankle, and then comes and stomps on. He comes off the second rope at various points. And the whole thing is so effective. And before going into it, I think what made it really effective is that they happen to be in Pillman's hometown of Cincinnati, doing this show at the Cincinnati Gardens. And they get the stomps, the forearms. Pillman, he's walking with a cane, or at least he has a cane with him, and that's what he gets hit with on the ankle. The whole thing in and of itself is such a quality beatdown, but there are certain things that maybe get ignored in the whole thing because of Pillmanizing being invented. The Jerry Briscoe run-in, usually when you see the agents come out, you know, occasionally they'll take bumps. You get Patterson getting thrown around in the back when the Mega Powers exploded that time. And Jerry Briscoe, holy crap, he basically commits suicide on behalf of getting Stone Cold Steve Austin even more over, because Austin throws him through the ropes and Briscoe takes a hellacious bump because he does not grab the rope or the ring apron to kind of slow down his fall. He just goes out like, whew, it's just a total crash. Tony Garea ain't doing that, I'll tell you that. Now Austin comes off the second rope, does the Pillmanizing from there as well, and the locker room starts to empty. And JR with the, well, I could hear the bone re-breaking. And that is something that they would have to do in order to fix Pillman's ankle, is re-break it, which is something, whew, that sounds horrible going in. I mean, yeah, I guess they put you under, but the whole notion of we have to re-break your arm or re-break your foot or something to set it, that ain't good. There is also an Austin 316 sign in the crowd. And as I mentioned, Austin's starting to get some cheers, but doing something like this, and as I said, Pillman's hometown, ensures that he's going to be booed for it instead of being cheered for how badass it is, although he is attacking a crippled guy. I mean, if you're cheering it obliquely, just, you know, from the fact that the guy can't really defend himself, you are kind of a bad person. But, you know, putting that all aside, it's a shame that they did have to write off Brian Pillman. Because it was so fun even having him around in the Hart Foundation as part of that angle for as little bit of time that lasted. If we could have had him through the end of 96 into 97, have him in that main event mix. Not even to speak of everything that happened after he passed away, where he's part of the Attitude Era, and he almost certainly would have been a huge part of that. I don't think necessarily maybe to Steve Austin's level, but he's somebody that certainly would have been in the conversation. I do want to read from the book Crazy Like a Fox, the definitive chronicle of Brian Pillman by Liam O'Rourke, and talking about this angle and some of the background for it. In the meantime, a trip to the doctor for Brian in early October brought back poor results. His ankle hadn't healed correctly, the result of Pillman traveling around the country to do shows, putting weight on it when he shouldn't have. The infection had also done a number on the ankle's ability to restore itself, and Brian was dejected to hear the doctor tell him that it would need to be rebroken. The healing process would need to begin all over again. Worse, the ankle was in such bad shape that the only way it could be repaired would be to permanently fuse the ankle into one position. The restriction this would place on his movement would be significant. He was again told that he wouldn't be able to run anymore, but there were no other options. And it continues along. The following day, and this is after Raw, they taped the Superstars on a Tuesday, WWF taped Superstars in Cincinnati, the perfect place to vilify Austin. In conducting an interview with Steve, Brian began touting Bret Hart's return in a babyface manner, earning him the scorn of Stone Cold. Austin even acknowledged that once upon a time, he and Brian had been a tandem, stating that he'd once carried him to a world championship in the Bush Leagues. As the interview came to a close, Pillman referred to Bret by his often said handle of the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be, who was attacked by a rabid Austin. As Pillman rose to his feet, Austin took Brian's own cane and broke it over his ankle. Steve followed it up by taking a steel chair, threading Brian's ankle through it, and stomping on the seat, providing the visual effect of crushing or snapping the bone. It was a powerful angle, so much that the technique used is to this day called Pillmanizing as part of wrestling parlance. And now the aftermath. 24 hours later, Brian was on the operating table again. Talk started going around that the ankle was destroyed and there was a possibility that there would never be a full recovery. Brian was quick to defuse it, telling everybody that he'd be back in early 1997. "He was always telling me he was going to be able to come back. He always said that," mentions Dave Meltzer, "even though I don't know it was as sure as he would lead everyone to believe." And yes, he was kind of a prisoner of the wrestling business because he had used the business to create this character and for himself where he just became the hottest name in the industry in early 1996 when the business was about to become as hot as it ever was. It's just the most unfortunate timing of all time. I mean, we all know that he did eventually wrestle, said in the Hart Foundation angle, did the story with Goldust, and then he passes away in October of 1997. So when did he actually debut in the ring? It wasn't until May of 1997 when he did debut at a house show, and he was around from time to time. He announced on Shotgun Saturday Night starting in, I believe it was March of 97. I think it may have been his first show, the one that I covered back in episode 13. We never really got the proper blow-off between these two guys because Pillman starts feuding with Goldust in the summer. Austin is more concerned with Owen and the IC title once he moves off of Bret. So it never really happened. Of course, there were other elements to this angle that, if you notice, I have not mentioned, such as, oh, I don't know, a certain gun angle that would take place 8 days after this aired on the USA Network with Monday Night Raw debuting at 8 o'clock rather than their old 9 o'clock time slot. And doing the whole gun thing and the way that they shot it, it came off as really sort of a cheap stunt. Of course, it wouldn't be the last cheap stunt involving Brian Pillman that Vince McMahon would, you know, try to pull off, with the worst and most disgusting being interviewing Melanie Pillman less than 48 hours after her husband passed away on Monday Night Raw. Yeah, for me, this is the saddest what if in pro wrestling history, where you have a guy who had been in the business for about a decade, and he finally creates and cultivates this character that catches fire, and then he has the accident and is just never the same, and within 18 months of him signing the contract, he's dead.
If you like it raw, then you'll love the new WWF Raw magazine. This no-holds-barred magazine brings all the sheer power, intensity, and sex appeal that is Raw up close and personal. It's an adult magazine for the mature audience. If you're 18 or older, you can call 1-888-WWF-NEWS and get 50% off the newsstand price. Don't miss your chance to get the only magazine that can bring you the in-your-face action and behind-the-scenes sizzle that is Raw. The WWF Raw magazine.
Look, I'm just finally starting to accept Todd Pettengill as okay, as completely tolerable. I don't need him talking about sex appeal, especially when it comes to Raw magazine. which is what launched Vince Russo upon the pro wrestling world. So maybe, unless it was a long game to eliminate WCW, which I doubt because nobody is that smart. So when they come back from the commercial break, Austin is still out at ringside, just kind of being a complete maniac. And, you know, I'm focused more on Brian Pillman and the tragedy of him, because you can't help but talk about that. But Steve Austin, 1996, is so great because he looks truly psychotic. Like, he just does not care. He's taking sort of that Waylon Mercy dynamic from a year prior and just going to the next level with it. I'll talk about Brian Pillman cultivated this character. Well, the light bulb went on for Stone Cold Steve Austin at a certain point when, I don't know, perhaps he was given a little bit more freedom, or suggests that, you know, he could say and do certain things that were more in line with his actual attitude. Like he says on his own podcast, at least when Ted Fowler isn't on there, that the best characters are the actual guy turned up to 10 or 11 in Spinal Tap's case. So with Austin still wandering around ringside and they're trying to help Brian Pillman out and bring him to the back and put him into an ambulance, Jim Ross tosses it to the previous Sunday's free-for-all before the In Your House Buried Alive pay-per-view. And Ahmed Johnson has a few things to say, and I am sure that they are extremely eloquent and thoughtful.
Now, I promise you, I swear to you, I will pay you back. You don't know when, you don't know where, you don't know how, but I will pay you back.
He is eloquent, and he is thoughtful.
Oh my God, I actually understood what Ahmed Johnson was saying, although he was saying it so calmly and rationally. When he's saying, I'm going to pay you back, it doesn't mean, like, I'm going to violently assault you, which is exactly what he did to Farouk. It sounds like Farouk loaned him $700 to get new tires for his car, so I'm like, I will pay you back. I will pay you back, Farouk, but they show the footage of Ottawa Senators Farouk. This is the original character with the ridiculous costuming laid out and attacked by Ahmed Johnson. So Gorilla Monsoon goes on Livewire. Very active WWF president. Certainly a little bit more in the scene than Jack Tunney, who, you know, I said things were probably going on with Tunney's underlings that even he didn't know about. I'm not sure that that was necessarily happening with Gorilla Monsoon, who the hosts of Livewire are Sonny and Doc Hendricks. So he joins them and he suspends Ahmed Johnson.
I am at this time levying a suspension not to exceed 30 days on Ahmed Johnson. And during the suspension period, my office will conduct a complete investigation into this matter. Now, I'm sure that the investigation is not going to take 30 days, but when it is completed, I will make everyone aware of my findings and subsequent concessions.
I'd really like to know more about what goes on for a Gorilla Monsoon investigation. I mean, after all, this is the guy when somebody is announced at 345 pounds, Gorilla would be like, oh, I think he's over that 450-pound mark. So sometimes he doesn't really pay close attention. With weights and measures, he's not particularly good with that. He doesn't really seem to have a staff. None of these investigators are actually named. Does he actually recuse himself when he feels like there might be bias on his part? Like if he was to investigate Jacques Rougeau, as an example, because of that derogatory song about him?
What disgusting music!
I don't know. I have concerns that he might abuse the powers of his office to go after his enemies. Like, oh, I don't know, the NFL and Tom Brady several years ago over that complete nonsense that was nothing. Although I am staring at my Roger Goodell autographed football that was given to me for Christmas a couple of years ago. And for those of you out there who are interested, yes, the commish did write Merry Christmas, Pete, on there. So he is a Merry Christmas and not a Happy Holidays kind of guy. Pillman is still being carried out. So we get a rehash of Mr. Perfect's quote-unquote injury and suspension from Gorilla Monsoon and the Mark Mero Triple H match from Raw, where Mr. Perfect has a chair and they're doing that thing where he looks like, oh, he's going to hit Triple H with it, clearly, but instead he turns and swings. It hits Mark Mero square in the head, which is very jarring to watch from 2018 eyes.
And I thought you were going to use it on Helmsley. Well, watch this Wade Boggs swing. And listen to this impact right here.
You know how good that felt. I've been waiting to do that to Mero for over a month.
So I guess that was the first episode of Everybody Hates Mark Mero, because that would be a recurring show for years to come. But I'm glad they brought up Wade Boggs's name, because he's a pal of Mr. Perfect dating back to the 1992 vignettes from when he is playing baseball, and then he's with athletes from other sports as well. And then when he's inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame posthumously in 2007, Wade Boggs is there to induct him as well. And Boggsy, always a favorite of mine as a kid, being a Red Sox player from 1982 to 1992. And the one thing I remember about him, and it's kind of an unusual thing, is that my father got the Bill James Baseball Abstract, not every year, but for 1984, it was actually one of the first ones that was widely available. And what I find interesting about it is this is only a couple of years into Wade Boggs' career. He came up in 1982, and this covers through the 1983 season. And it takes a stab at projecting Wade Boggs' career. And it's pretty scary how close it is on a bunch of these things, because it has him playing through 1999 and has him finishing with 3,023 hits, which is within 13. He ended up with 3,010 hits. And it was a little high on home runs, but it was correspondingly a little low on doubles. And it had him finishing with a career average of 345, but he actually ended with a career average of, I believe it was 326 or 328, which I think can be explained away by the last couple of years of his career and the year he hit 259 with the Red Sox in 1992, which is pretty inexplicable considering that the 10 years previous to that and then the 4 years after that, he's never anywhere below 302 in any of those years. So he was kind of the perfect hitter for his time. He walked a lot. He was never appreciated properly for it, and he never struck out. Hardly ever, even for guys at the time when strikeouts were less common. Wade Boggs did not strike out very often, although he struck out to end Dave Rigetti's no-hitter in 1983. It always kind of makes me feel good to know that Mr. Perfect Curt Hennig and Wade Boggs were close pals. If ever there was anybody in the world of music who cultivated a wrestling-type gimmick for him or herself, there is Marilyn Manson. Although, the thing that everybody wants to talk about, or the only thing about Marilyn Manson people talk about, is the one thing that he has in common with Leapin' Lanny Poffo. And I'm just going to leave it at that, because I try to run a clean show here. But speaking of gimmicks, coming up next, we have Justin Hawk Bradshaw in his Stan Hansen imitation cover band phase taking on Dennis Haskins. Oh, excuse me, David Haskins. It is not Mr. Belding.
Hey, what is going on here?
It's not completely impossible that Mr. Belding would be on a wrestling program. I mean, he is a fan. He was in one of those Zack Ryder videos, apparently, that Long Island Z business, and was on the JBL and Cole show once, which I guess is probably the most tolerable version of JBL that we got in this century, I would say. But this particular version of Bradshaw, or Justin Hawk Bradshaw, because he was John Hawk coming up through the ranks and global and all that, there's something about him, and I don't know how to describe what he looks like. Yes, he's imitating Stan Hansen, but to me, he looks like the Darkest Timeline version of Chris Hero, but without wearing like the fake basketball getup that he does, you know, more recently in NXT. Just really more annoying than Chris Hero, and not somebody who had a celebrated career on the independents a few years ago. Like, none of that. Instead, more of a history of being a dick and bullying and stuff like that. I don't mind doing what you have to do to carve out a lengthy career for yourself, but I also try to live my life by the credo of don't be a dick, and Bradshaw kind of fails in that regard, and that's even without bringing up the Mauro Ranallo business from a couple of years ago. Bradshaw actually misses a charge early and gets rolled up for two, so this Haskins guy has a bit of spunk. And if this wasn't a holiday week and I had more time to do a bunch of different edits to songs and maybe kind of a mashup, I would take that. I found somebody on YouTube put together this Principal Belding supercut of all the times that he used his catchphrase, hey, what is going on in here? I would take stuff like what's going on, and I would insert it into the Marvin Gaye song, maybe use hey, you know, for like, shout by something like that. Hey. I mean, this is much more interesting than talking about Justin Hawk Bradshaw in 1996. Big boot off a reverse Irish whip. And then he turns to the crowd and does the Stan Hansen thing, you know, where he puts up his arm and goes, hoo! That is a bit bothersome, but JR, and they're talking about the concept of investigations, and I guess this kind of goes back to my point about what would a Gorilla Monsoon investigation actually look like. Well, Jim Ross, with his recent antics with fake Razor and fake Diesel, he was investigated, and he certainly feels wronged by the entire process.
I want to wish you the best in this legal battle you're going to have with Gorilla Monsoon. Lee, I had an investigation. They investigated my dealings. They found nothing wrong. I felt like Richard Jewell, that security guard down in Atlanta. He got accused of everything, but he was innocent.
If you forgot who Richard Jewell was, he was the security guy who pointed out that there was a backpack in Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta and helped clear people away from it and prevented more deaths in the Olympic Park bombing of 1996. And what happened was they accused him of staging the entire thing in order to be called a hero, and the media basically jumped all over him when, in fact, he had done nothing of the kind. And, in fact, they ended up killing him because of all the media pressure, although I guess he wasn't in the best shape as it was, because he was built pretty much like Andy Reid. So, there is that. But it's the most shameful thing that American media ever did. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution ended up paying a big libel settlement out of it because, as I recall, their defense was, well, he's now a public figure, so now we can say anything we want about him, which is kind of a bad thing when you're really drilled down. Belly-to-back suplex by Bradshaw, who appears to be auditioning for All Japan Pro Wrestling and just dumping guys on their head. I wish he had gone, you know, because it would have been far, far away from where I am. I'd like to get Bradshaw to the furthest point on the planet from where I am at any possible time. I actually looked it up the other day, and the furthest major city from where I am is Perth, Australia. Which is something that I could have guessed, because furthest point on the planet is somewhere, I think, in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And I would settle for sending Bradshaw there as well. A senton and some elbows, and a vertical suplex by Bradshaw is converted into just dumping Haskins onto the top rope. So now he's imitating moves that the New Rockers did earlier in the show. Another flash inside cradle by Mr. Belding gets a two. Someone, hey, what is going on here? Why is this enhancement talent getting these flash pin attempts? Now, I was a bit worried because Jim Ross had not brought up football at all on this entire program, at least that I can recall. I at least never noted it earlier. He talks about how later today, Bradshaw's favorite team, the Dallas Cowboys, is going to be taking on the Miami Dolphins. And, of course, because I had to look up what happened in that game. JR, his pal Barry Switzer, former coach of Oklahoma, is the coach of the Dallas Cowboys at that time. And the Cowboys did beat Miami 29-10. And Troy Aikman, 33 of 41 for 363 yards and 3 touchdowns. Hell of a performance for Troy, who I always think was kind of an underrated part of that Cowboys dynasty. I think he gets sold short just because of how great Emmitt Smith and Michael Irvin were. Although Irvin, 12 catches, 186 yards, and a touchdown. It's kind of a homecoming game for him. I don't know if he had played in Miami as a member of the Cowboys since He was one of the more famous players from the U in the University of Miami. Big Lariat ends up picking up the win for Bradshaw, and now he's got to brand his opponent because he's ripping off Terry Funk as well. He's got Zebekiah there with him, Dirty Dutch Mantel, or just Dirty, but he doesn't really have a presence, so there's not much to speak of. And Bradshaw is kind of like the Hanna-Barbera of wrestlers, where, you know, why do something original and carve your own path when you can just rip off Stan Hansen, Terry Funk, all those guys? This annoying, annoying character just ripping off these legends, like how Hanna-Barbera would rip off the Honeymooners and just kind of take the exact same concept, exact same voice styles and so on, and call it the Flintstones. I have no problem with the Flintstones by any means, but just go down the list of various Hanna-Barbera shows. Not exactly the most original thought there. It is the Justin Hawk Bradshaw of cartoon companies.
The ambulance is leaving on its way out the exit. And wait a minute. Wait, keep it here. Keep it here. Somebody's blocking the exit.
It's Stone Cold.
Stone Cold Steve Austin's blocked the exit in that car.
Oh, he's not done yet. Come on.
Steve Austin certainly taking it to another level in 1996, wherein he will block the ambulance from leaving the guy that he injured earlier in the show. He threw away the car keys to keep them from moving his vehicle, although they would get it back. And I have to say that Austin getting run over by that car backstage at the 1999 Survivor Series, probably karmic retribution for this sort of thing. He should be, you know, he should follow the rules a little bit in that backstage area, because, you know, things can happen. The funniest thing about this entire thing, other than Austin opens the back of the ambulance and starts taunting and yelling at him, and I also was kind of expecting Austin to be actually driving the ambulance, but we're gonna do that angle a little bit later with Brett. Don't worry about it. Maybe that jogged their memory and gave them that idea to do that at some point down the road. But Dave Hebner, and it is Dave, it is the road agent Hebner, gets all up in Austin's grill. Like, you know, like, this guy's so fat, Austin could just beat the absolute hell out of him, and I don't know why he doesn't. And Dave Hebner just gets in shotgun and rides to the hospital. I guess because he has Brian Pillman's insurance card or something. Oh, wait, that's right. There's no insurance card because they are independent contractors, right?
AJ had to go there. A shot clock was not reset on the block. Imagine. Thought he was fouled there.
Technical foul.
And now he just bumped the official.
There are two main things that I remember about Magic Johnson's comeback with the Lakers in 1996. The first one is that he announced it about a week after I saw the Lakers play the Celtics at the Fleet Center in Boston, and being mad, like, oh, you couldn't have come out of retirement 2 weeks before this so that I could have seen you play, because I never got to see Magic play, because, I mean, seeing the Lakers from in the 80s against the Celtics, I mean, that was pretty much an impossible ticket. And then, secondly, that time he bumped an official, which was more accidental than some other ref bumps that occurred in the NBA. In fact, earlier in Magic's comeback that year, fellow Laker Nick Van Exel shoved referee Ronnie Garrison over the scorer's table, and Magic was actually there in the middle of it to break it up, and spoke out and said that, you know, that Van Exel needed to be punished, and this was completely unacceptable. Magic kind of stepped the wrong way in front of the official and bumped him that way with what happened. So, I don't know. When you have a nice smile, you're willing to excuse a lot. And speaking of guys with nice smiles, we wrap the show up with Psycho Sid, and he is taking on Jason Grimm, or is it Jared Grimm? It doesn't really matter, because both Grimm twins are going to be involved in this match, and I'm sure. Sid's got a great smile. I don't care what anybody says. I don't know what kind of dentist he goes to. He does have very similar hair to Dr. Isaac Yankum, DDS. So I have no idea. Probably not, since, Yankum was a doctor in well, you know, Sid was from West Memphis, Arkansas. I mean, he could have gone to a dentist in Tennessee. You never really know. Sid is everything that I hoped and dreamed for him. In late 1996, just a pure babyface, holding signs from the crowd up in the air, and just fist bumping all the fans on the way to the ring. It's just so cool. I have to mention that on the video copy that I had of this, there's 1 minute left in the video when Sid is coming to the ring. And it actually runs out very early in the match. But luckily, I had a second copy provided to me a long time ago via DVD. Listener Michael Vincent sent that to me. So thank you for that, because I would have hated to miss a complete Sid squash match. This particular matchup got me thinking of something, because the Grimm Twins, you may know them best as the Harris Twins, who would famously have, you know, maybe Nazi-ish tattoos on their person. So you can probably infer that they were not great supporters of Barack Obama. I'm not going to say that they're definitely supporters of Donald Trump, but let's accept that premise that they voted for him, if they actually did vote. And we know how Sid feels about Trump supporters, to the point where he will boycott indie shows just based on Trump's travel ban, even if it has nothing to do with him. He will boycott indie shows, or more accurately, no show, if the promoter may have done something for the Republican at one point, the Republican president. So that's fine. So it got me thinking about, you know, with all the talk about the Democratic nominees, you know, Beto O'Rourke, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris. We can't have a Kamala Harris running for president when we already had a Kamala Harris as an actual pro wrestler. So what I'm saying is, I think Sid Udy should throw his hat into the ring for president as a Democrat, because how exactly are they going to stop him? I mean, I could just see him powerbombing Beto O'Rourke, and, you know, it might freak out the squares a little bit, but, and also in the debates, I think, you know, given the Trump strategy of really kind of not giving a crap of what people said, I feel like Sid could really thrive in this environment where he could just answer, like, he could basically just use a sound machine for his answers of past things that he said.
I am not a board of your door!
All right, well, he might not fare best in party politics, so maybe he should just kind of go off on his own and run as an independent. Maybe he could run on the Reform Party ticket. That's always worked out for pro wrestlers in the past. And he dominates early. He throws Jason out of the ring, where they do the switch with Jared on the outside. And this is where the tape of my video runs out, so I have to switch to the DVD. So he's pretty much facing both guys, which is interesting because I had a weird recollection of Sid facing both the Harris twins in WCW, like late stage WCW, when he was the champion. And sure enough, in the year 2000, he did face the Harris twins, but he had Vampiro there as his partner. I'm thinking, we should get Sid and Vampiro together as a broadcast team. You know, Vampiro, so the celebrated color man on Lucha Underground. The Grimm Twins actually get an advantage here and start working on Sid's back. And it does, you know, I have to be honest, while I like Sid and all, his selling is not exactly up to snuff, which reminds you that in the 80s, what made Hogan special and great was that Hulk Hogan could sell his ass off in a match and build sympathy like that. And it was something that you'd have to do it with Sid very differently. You'd have to almost give him sort of the Goldberg treatment. And he grabs one of the Grimms. I mean, whoever it is, it really doesn't matter. Let's just say it was the less racist one. It goes for the choke slam, but then they switch again and they go to an ad break. Now, at this point, I said, I'm on the DVD. I could pull the sound clip. And they talk to Shawn Michaels, because, of course, he's about to face Sid coming up at the Survivor Series. And who I don't really care what Sean had to say. I bet you he says something like, I got news for you. I know Sid's a big man, but I got news for you. I can, you know, fly high and I'm the champ and blah, 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 blah. It's probably something like that. If you heard one Sean interview, you got to say, I got news for you about three times. I mean, in reality, Sean said that Bret Hart taught him that there are no friends, and he's going to keep that in mind going into this bout. Sid misses on a clothesline, but then scores with the choke slam on one of the Grimm twins, and that picks up the 1-2-3 for the big man as he heads to Survivor Series. He nails the other one with the big boot, just for good measure, and then clotheslines each of them over the top rope. So a pretty impressive squash for Sid here at a time in his career where, to me, he is particularly enjoyable, even if there are stretches in this match that are not exactly playing to his strengths. And that does it for WWF Superstars for October 27th, 1996. And this show is certainly running a bit longer than I thought it would for something that was going to kind of a makeshift show. I do not have a plan for next week's show. I may do something of a special sort of show that is somewhat non-traditional. I'm batting around a couple of different ideas. And I do remind you to check out Friends of the Show, the wrestling podcast about nothing with Mike Crockett and Ring of Honor's own Brian Malonis of the Bouncers, as they got some clips of an interview that they did in 2016 with Tommaso Ciampa. And this is kind of famous. If you've been listening to that show, this is an interview that they were not allowed to release for mysterious reasons having to do with permissions or something or other. But they are able to play a little bit more of it on the show this week. And on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, it is their annual holiday special, so be sure to check that out. And season 8 of the Sportscasters with my Adams Division podcast partner Steve Bennett is over, so taking a little break and watching the Buffalo Sabres, no doubt trying to cling to third place in the Atlantic Division. Why you'd want to do that, I don't know, because you're better off finishing fourth and going over to the Metropolitan Division with all the weaker teams. So that's it for other podcasts. And I should also mention one other thing about my Christmas. And this is something of a confession, and it's also wrestling related as well. Because my father-in-law, he's a fun-loving guy. But there was this plastic fly that the 8-year-old boys were kind of screwing around with, trying to hide it in people's food and, you know, kind of get them and rib them, I guess, in a certain way. Well, eventually, my father-in-law, he just got sick of it and said, you know what, I'm gonna eat the bug and it'll be gone forever. I'm like, why don't you just throw it away? I'm like, nope, I'm going to eat it. So he threw the plastic bug in his mouth and chugged it down with some Budweiser and everybody laughed. And then he pointed out how, I guess, years ago he had part of his colon taken out. And I am ashamed to say that I stole a joke that Jameson told on a 1991 episode of Primetime Wrestling.
Yeah, they had to take out part of my colon.
You're kidding.
Oh, don't say. Don't start talking about your colon here.
Now I got a semicolon.
I make that joke and the house comes unglued at that. Stole a joke from Jameson and no one's the wiser about any of that. So everybody just having a good time. That's what Christmas is all about. That and, you know, the baby born in the manger in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, or something like that. I forget the exact story. It's been a long time since I had CCD class. So thank you so much for listening. And do tell a friend about Greetings from Allentown or leave a 5-star review on iTunes/Apple Music. Because that provides what is known as social proof that you're enjoying listening to this podcast for what it is. God, I'm losing my mind. I'm going right up to the limits with this show. God. Oh, the holidays will do this to me. So I'll just wrap it up here. Again, thank you so much for listening, and do tune in next Thursday for what'll be something, another edition of Greetings from Allentown.
New York wins! New York!